hopefully you're here to see this. I'll hand over to Kevin in just a second. But just for those of you who don't know Kevin, he's a fellow of the Institute and a CIRA, currently a lecturer at the Centre of Actuarial Studies at Melbourne Uni, and his research involves quantitative modelling of asset and liability portfolios of pension funds and insurers. Over to you, Kevin.
Just to start, among many scientific discoveries over the centuries, the pioneering work of Richardson, Lewis Fry Richardson, in 1922, has provided the mathematical theory of weather prediction used today. The subsequent technological advances of high-speed computers have allowed Richardson's work to be exploited by modern-day meteorological teams who coordinate their efforts to predict weather patterns on Earth, particularly extreme weather patterns such as floods. This talk today will describe some preliminary work in applying non-predictors of rainfall over Australia to forecasting extreme rainfall events and linking these to flood events. So, quick outline, current flood warning systems, what does the Bureau of Meteorology do right now? We'll talk a little bit about the background of Australia's weather system, what drives Australia's weather. We'll look at some historical flood events, and then we'll wind up by looking at the prediction techniques that have been applied to forecasting extreme rainfall events which are associated with flood events. And then we'll have five takeaway points in our conclusions. So, just historically speaking, people, your first weather warning system was used when they had the telegraph. That was a big advance a couple of centuries ago. You had in 1788, Lieutenant William Dawes on the First Fleet. He had his little weather station that accompanied him. And from day one, when the British colonised Australia, they were always interested in weather prediction. And it remained in many ways the big enemy of industries that followed the agribusiness and, of course, the wheat industry, which was a big industry in Australia in the later 1800s. But in 1922, Lewis Fry Richardson, he wrote a book called Weather Prediction by Numerical Process. It was too advanced for anyone to work it out. They had to employ all these mathematicians. And I think he had a team so big, they could get something out within a couple of weeks. When they had brought on the computer in the 1960s, they were able to actually have weather forecasting. And that was done in America. Then you had the launch of the first meteorological satellite. So, leading on now, what you've got is the Bureau of Meteorology, the Global Analysis and Prediction System. It's got an 85-kilometre resolution, which is state-of-the-art. It's got a consensus of seven models. So, that gets us to today. If you want to, for example, what is done now with flood warning systems, yes, they've got rainfall and stream flow observations. Yes, they've got numerical weather predictions with radar and satellite. They've got the hydrological models. The Bureau of Meteorology coordinates all these with local authorities, with river gauge data, etc., to try and anticipate floods and then take action regarding these. So it focuses on riverine floods after heavy rainfall. The topic of this talk, of course, is a bit narrower, and because of the data that's not available to us, and that's something to be done later, we can only focus on the rainfall data from the Bureau of Meteorology and using some data analysis techniques to try and forecast those. Australia's weather. Let's just talk about Australia's weather. So the bigger picture, of course, is we're going to apply a statistical model here, and we just want to identify which factors are most useful. So we've got 23 different factors. I'm going to go through them with you pretty quickly, and then we'll look at the results from the data analysis. So first of all, your solar influences, the sun drives all your weather on Earth. Big source of energy, pretty straightforward. heat hits the equator, and then you've got to transfer the heat down to the poles. That's a whole bunch of interaction that occurs. And to get an indication of the level of solar energy, you can look at the sunspot numbers, which wax and wane, typically with an 11 to 12 year cycle. They've been observed for 3 centuries or so. The sunspot activity has been extrapolated backwards. And some of the, if you like, what they found was that, according to one article I read, the length of the solar cycle is indicative of lower temperatures in the subsequent cycle by about 1 to 2 degrees. And it's purported that this was due to the, this actually brought about the little mini ice age, I think, in the 1700s when you had the Maunder minimum around that time. So I'm just giving you here, obviously, a bit of background to what we're using in our predictor model. What else you got? You got distance from Earth. Now, pretty obvious, the Earth rotates about the Sun. It's an elliptical pattern. Now, the variation goes from 131 million kilometres at its perihelion, and its aphelion, it's 190 million kilometres. So that's a significant difference. That's one of the, another predictive factor that we've employed. Another one is simply your seasons, the tilt of the Earth. Now, a lot of this was already worked out. They had a Serbian astronomer called Milankovic in the 1920s. And for long-dated weather forecasting, they used cycles, so as in the precession of the Earth, Earth's tilt, and variations in the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit. That's for very long-dated stuff. We're not going to worry about that. Incidentally, we're looking at a one-month time horizon on flood prediction with what we're doing here. So, yes, there is scope to do long-range weather forecasting with some of the predictive factors, but we'll just focus on 1 month ahead. What else have we got? Well, that's your solar factors out of the way. We're going to look at four weather systems, or four weather indices. Your first one is your Indian Ocean Dipole. Then you've got your Southern Oscillation Index, your Southern Annular Mode, and lastly, your Madden-Julian Oscillation. Now, as I say, I'm not an atmospheric physicist. We're just using this data to try and predict flood events. But let's just talk about what each one means. So, well, we've already been through that one. Let's just, forgive me, people, I'll just backtrack a little bit, and I had a whole bunch of graphs here, so let's get this sorted out. I'm just going ahead of myself. So really, here's your sunspot activity. I should have just shown you this. This is your sunspot activity. It's been measured over the centuries. Now, your sunspot is a concentration of magnetic flux activity. It is actually has lower temperatures than its surrounding aspect, surrounding areas on the photosphere of the sun. It's about 2,000 degrees centigrade cooler. So you could argue that the sunspot number is a measure of solar inactivity. But it's the length, what they're saying is that the length of the sunspot cycle, this distance here, the longer that is, the lower your temperatures, lesser energy hitting Earth. So that's a factor. Now, it does, these have been measured by different astronomers over the centuries. And it's only now that we're really starting to understand what's happening, as I say. Continuing on, here's your perihelion and your aphelion. That actually is a bit different. That's different. These numbers are different to what I told you. That's because the eccentricity is actually different. That is not accurate, in other words. So here's your Indian Ocean Dipole. Let's just talk a bit about this. It's your difference in sea surface temperatures between a place in the Arabian Sea and a place in the northeast part of the Indian Ocean. That difference in temperature gives rise to a cycle. It's called a dipole because you've got two parts. You've got a convective dipole in the northeastern part of Australia, and we'll show you that right now. So this is it in what they call negative phase. This is your Indian Ocean dipole in negative phase. So you've got increased convection occurring in the northeastern part of the Indian Ocean. You've got warmer than normal water temperatures here. And what's happening is you're getting winds blowing across the Indian Ocean, westerlies, and they're bringing rain to the northern part of Australia. This is your Indian Ocean dipole effect in action. This is in the negative phase. And then you've got winds at higher altitudes, they're blowing across the top. So you've got this cycle. And as I said, when it's in negative phase, you're getting a lot of rainfall up the top of Australia. In positive phase, it brings about a lot of flood events over Africa. So as I say, it's important to understand all these drivers when we come to predicting what's happening. So that's it. Here's what your graph looks like. Now, if you're going to do any statistical analysis, this is what you'd be looking at. I've just left out all the mathematics and analysis here for you today. But continuing on, what's our next one? Your Southern Oscillation Index. Well, this measures your El Nino Southern Oscillation effect. The Indian Ocean dipole, which we just looked at, has often been coined the Indian Ocean El Nino effect. It's exactly the same type of process, but this one occurs in the Pacific. So you've got these, this one here, the Southern Oscillation Index, it measures the strength of the El Nino effect. It's the difference in barometric pressure over the Pacific Ocean. It measures the strength of the Walker circulation, and the Walker circulation is simply what we're talking about here. So you've got strong trade winds. They're blowing westward, easterlies. They're bringing about convective rainfall on the northern part of Australia. And then you've got, of course, your high altitude winds creating that cycle, the Walker circulation. So this is measured by your Southern Oscillation Index. This is what the graph looks like. Pretty meaningless. But the key thing is that when it's in, has an SOI value exceeding -8, then that's going to bring in rainfall to Australia. So that's what we want to be looking at as one of our predictive factors. Here's your other one, the Southern Annular Mode. This one isn't a dipole effect as with the previous two. What we're looking at, we've got westerly winds that circle Antarctica. They operate in latitudes of 50 to 90 degrees or above 50 degrees latitude south. And what that does is when you get summer in Australia, that tilt, what you get is a movement of these westerly winds more towards the equator, and it brings about rainfall in southern Australia. So that's what's happening there. On the other hand, in the winter time, the Southern Annular Oscillation, these westerly winds contract towards south, the higher south pole. Basically, it leads to a drier situation in Australia during those times. So that's your Southern Oscillation Index. Yes, it's associated with increased storms and rain. And here's your, look, I'm only showing you some graphs here because this is what the things look like. As it turns out, it doesn't tell you. We're going to use all this data to predict, so look, let's just move on. Lastly, we've got our Madden-Julian Oscillation. Now, this was discovered in the early 70s by a couple of meteorologists, Madden and Julian. And what they did is they looked at, this is a dipole now that we spoke about the Indian Ocean dipole and of course the El Nino Southern Oscillation Index. What are we looking at now? We're looking at a dipole effect, but this one operates in the tropics. Same principle. You've got a convective upward stream, that convective rainfall, and then associated with that, you've got another dipole which has suppressed convective activity. So again, you've got this cycle that occurs, but with the Madden-Julian Oscillation, you've got 8 phases, if you like, and each phase denotes its location over the tropics. So what you end up having, and I haven't got the graph here, well, this shows you what's going on. So here's your Madden-Julian Oscillation. You've got this dipole that's occurring, you've got upward motion here, you've got your rainfall coming up here, you got your high altitude winds, they say at 200 millibars altitude, and then you've got a downward motion and you've got a cycle. Now, that's one cycle. You've got another cycle. The Madden-Julian oscillation, actually, this dipole rotates around the tropics. It circumnavigates the globe every 60 days, roughly. And, as I say, it was discovered in the 70s, and it is responsible for a lot of rainfall over the northern parts of Australia. So that's another background, bit of background for you. So they're your main indicators. Now, we also looked at a couple of other indicators there, people. And I mentioned them to you. Let's go back to them. We're also going to look at another few factors here. Your proximity to your ocean, your latitude, your altitude. These are big influences on levels of rainfall. And then we're looking also at some temporal statistics, such as your average daily rainfall in the region. So that wraps it up. What's our rainfall data that we're looking at? Let's have a quick look, people. Here it is, sourced from the Bureau of Meteorology. We've got 181 weather stations all around Australia. Here's all the data. These are all the weather stations. Fairly data intensive. And we've got Tasmania and all the different parts of Australia there. Data going back over 100 years. Of course, the problem is you've got missing data. These are all issues you've got to deal with. And then you've got to try and analyse the data in such a way that your missing data doesn't pose a problem for your analysis. Here is your, call it your probability density function of rainfall amounts in Australia. So this is what we're looking at, people. I've had to take the logarithm of the density function to actually illustrate the difference in the tails and actually illustrate the difficulty in actually predicting these high intensity rainfall events. So what do we got here? We're looking at measuring out, and I'll show you in a second, we've got all the big flood events listed. We're trying to get out to around 100 millimetres rainfall intensity. This is all daily rainfall intensity data that we're looking at. I don't have anything more specific than that, which is a bit unfortunate, because a lot of your floods are flash floods, and obviously they're going to be over a short period of time, as we're just going to see when we look at a couple of flood events. But this gives us an idea. We want to be forecasting out around this region here. And I've had to take the logarithm simply because you would have no idea what we're looking at otherwise. Your mode for this distribution is zero. Most days it doesn't rain. So if you just wanted to, in the absence of any animation, I'm just going to click through this fairly quickly just to give you an idea. Here's January, Australia. This is a three-dimensional graph here, people, and the height represents the average rainfall in millimetres for the month. Okay, it's pretty basic stuff. And you got your longitude and your latitude. You should be able to make out Australia. But anyhow, here's January. You can see that you get a fair bit of rainfall up the top, as you know. But let's push ahead. February, March, April, May, June. Yes, you're getting a bit more over here in the Western Australia and Southeastern Australia. What do we got here? July, August, September, October, November, December. So that's what we're trying to predict, but extreme values of those. Moving on to the historical flood events. Look, you had a big one in 1893, February, in Brisbane. It surpassed the 1974 flood in its magnitude, as illustrated by the river gauge data. I'll show you that in a second. You had some other, I've only picked a handful of floods here, people. It's not exhaustive by any means. There was a big flood back in the 1830s. I don't have any rainfall data to connect with that. And in fact, I think John Oxley, 1825, up in Brisbane, he knew that when he landed there, there was a big flood. But obviously they had no one to measure it. You had the Hunter Valley, Northern Tasmanian flood, February 1929, up near Burnie. You had the Hunter Valley flood in February 55. Your Brisbane, January 1974, which I've been to another talk mentioned. Brisbane, January 2011. Of course, there was one little bit, a few months before that, October 2010. And yes, you had one up just north of Katherine in December 2011. So all I've done is I've just gone through each of these flood events and just had a look at the levels of rainfall that were associated with each of them. Now, again, we're only looking at extreme rainfall events and trying to link them to flood events. Far better analysis looks at all the hydrological influences, i.e. rainfall upstream leads to something happening downstream. So what have we got? Northern Tasmania, April 29. This is the name of the rainfall station. It wouldn't mean anything to you unless you live in the area. So it had 114 millimetres of rain. That was day two. Day three, 101 millimetres of rain. Then it came down with 83. That was massive. You look at the Hunter Valley flood. What do you got here? You're getting some big numbers here, up around 90, 100 millimetres in a day. Your Brisbane floods, same thing. You're getting over 100 millimetres. And then lastly, you got Brisbane, same thing. And then in Katherine, look at this, nothing, and then you get hit with 255 millimetres. Now, that is just at one rainfall station. The problem is, when you get these flood events, some of the rainfall stations don't work, and they actually have no readings. So you've got to deal with this situation. In an ideal world, and with a bit more time, probably we would have utilised, or I would have utilised, spatial modelling methods, where I can try and anticipate what's happening, but leave that for another day. So what are we looking at by way of our prediction techniques? We've looked at the data, we've looked at the causes of rainfall. Now we're going to just look at three different prediction methods. Ordinary least squares, which we've all heard of. Regression trees, less so. And then bootstrapped aggregation. So this is all an application of the data analytic techniques that everyone's talking about on all the other screens. So what have we got here? We're going to measure the success of a model by looking at its R squared. What is the R squared? If you've got a model and you've got the actual value being predicted and then you've got some error, then you calculate your R squared, obviously. And I'll tell you, even though it's obvious, I'm just telling you how I do it. R squared is 1 minus your variance of your error term divided by the variance of the actual value. Now, I'm telling you that because what you're going to see, you're going to see some negative R squareds. What does that tell you? Tells you, you're no good. Tells you that it's garbage. R squared can be negative using this method of calculation. It's brought about because your model brings in more uncertainty than what you're actually trying to forecast. Sounds ridiculous. So with the ordinary least squares regression, we're looking at durations 1 day, 2 day, 3 day, 4 day, 5 days. So we'll just try and predict extreme rainfall events with 1 day intensities. What we found, top four factors were your average daily rainfall at that location, your intensity of the sun at that rainfall station, your latitude, and lastly, your standard deviation. Now, what have we done here? Should have mentioned, we divided our data into two sets. One was all your rainfalls prior to 1990, up to the 31st of December, 89. We had an out-of-sample test from the 1st of January, 1990, onwards. So we've got about 2.5 decades of out of sample. Now the amount of data here is pretty big. It's over, I think you've got about 1.2 million data items that we've got to try and learn from, if you like. And then out of sample, we've got about 800,000 data items that we're going to test against. So how did we do with our ordinary least squares? Oh, we'll show you that in a second. But these were the top four factors. So all that solar activity that I told you didn't come out in this analysis. Where it does come into play is with the regression trees and with the bootstrapped aggregation. So match ordinary least squares. Let's just quickly talk about a regression tree, which everyone's heard about trees. And look, I'm just going to say this for the know-nothings in the audience. A regression tree, in its simplest form, is simply a node where you make a decision and you split. You have two emanating branches, and each branch corresponds to a classification where you would hope that the classification leads to a lower standard deviation or variance within each class. It's what insurers do when they say, are you smoking or are you a non-smoker? You're trying to separate your mortality risks. It's nothing new. Actuaries have been doing it for decades. So this is a regression trend. Then what do? Apply recursion. So what do you... You just recursively split each partition. Nothing magical with that. The problem is you could do this ad infinitum. In fact, you can fit your whole data set in sample. And that's what I'll show you that in a second. Because you're going to overfit the data, what are you going to do to overcome this situation? Well, use the consensus idea. You reconstruct a whole bunch of trees from your in-sample data and you use a technique called bootstrapping. It's just creating a new data set by sampling from your existing data. When we say sampling, what we're going to do is 1.1 million times, we're going to play a game, we're going to take one data item out of that, we're going to construct an artificial data set from our original one. We do that many times. That's called bootstrapping. You probably know that. Continuing on, the idea is that you're getting a consensus of several trees and it will give you a better out-of-sample performance. So here are your results, people. Commencing with your ordinary least squares, you're getting exceedingly low R-squareds. You can't explain much of the data with an ordinary least squares regression. Out-of-sample, it's just as bad, it's 8%. Nothing flash. This is just illustrating the difficulty in prediction, people. Continuing on, you've got a random regression tree here with 100 splits. 100 splits doesn't actually help you very much. Bearing in mind we have 23 predictive factors that we're using to forecast our rainfall and particularly extreme rainfall events. What a regression tree with 100 splits is going to do, it's just going to capture the body, but not too much of the tails. So what have we got to do? We've got to increase the number of splits. What's a split? It's a node, another word for a node. So in other words, you've got a tree, just as the fellow there who said, you've got to work out with wine tasting, you've got 10 people to choose, you only got 10 nodes in that one. You only got 10 nodes to work out which of the wines are poisonous. So too here. Which of the events will be flood events. So, not very good. Okay, random tree with 50,000 splits, you're getting a better R squared. 70%. You're bagging with 50,000 trees, 50,000 splits, that's a little bit better. 66%. But if you look at its performance out of sample, I think it's diabolical. Wouldn't even use it. Reminiscent of how they used to forecast weather in the late 1800s. They had all the best mathematicians working at the Bureau of Meteorology with paltry efforts. And here we go. For 2 days duration, you've got less volatility when the intensity is averaged over 2 days. You can get a far better fit in sample, but we're not travelling that well out of sample. Big problem. Things are a bit better. We move to 3 day durations. We're getting far better fit in sample, obviously, but still not that great out of sample. Same thing with 4 day, same thing with 5 day. But what are we trying to do? We're trying to predict extreme events beyond 90 millimetres of rainfall. To do that, you've got to have a regression tree with many more than 50,000 nodes, and you need to actually construct trees many more than, say, 200 trees. It's not good enough. The problem is the MATLAB application I used didn't have enough power. It broke down. So what was necessary was to resort to parallel computing. And here we go, people. Conclusions. Your bootstrapped aggregation does improve your results. Your R-square values are higher, obviously, for the high duration stuff, for your rainfall intensities. Unfortunately, it's your floods that occur over the shorter term, i.e. one day in flash floods. That's what you're interested in. So it's not much use so far, people. Your predictive power of your model's limited by the information you use and how you use it. And we can definitely improve the modelling by incorporating temperature data, hydrological data, topographical data, which is yet to be implemented. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. We do have 5 minutes for questions, so if anyone's got any questions, please come up to the microphone there and state your name and ask away.
Andrei Kwiatkowski, Auten General. You explained very well, thank you, how to predict the model used to predict extreme rainfall events. But I'm thinking in terms of flood, whether we need to take into account and to what degree we need to take into account the change in landscape or deforestation, development, et cetera, et cetera. Is it something that needs to be considered, and to what extent it needs to be considered?
I think it's very important, and the model I've showed you here is very much preliminary work and by no means adequate. Yes, you've got to take into account the topographical aspects. I mean, just recently you saw that in the news with the floods in Tasmania at the River Esk. It's hit narrow points. You're getting floods all the time up in northern parts of Australia. They happen every summer. And that's something that, well, we've got a couple of grants in process. We've applied for a couple of grants. And we're looking at getting data from Geoscience Australia. We want to get the whole thing mapped out. And we want to actually do some proper forecasting. So definitely that's where we were at. And look, we'd even seek any industry partnerships. At the University of Melbourne, we'll be looking at industry partnerships to try and do some work for industry, if need be, if required. So.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Will Gardner, Combus. I was just thinking, Kevin, more of a comment. Going forward, now that you've got all of the 23 parameters set up, and all the subroutines and everything written for your code, might be interesting to take away flood, try the bushfire risk. Yes. You've got the same meteorological data, you can calculate your forest fire danger index,
yes.
And it might be interesting to do the same regression tests on the bushfire risk and see if anything comes out.
That's a very good thought. In fact, one of the factors I left out in the conclusion was simply temperature data. I just didn't have time to get all the temperature data together before the thing. And naturally enough, having gone to some other talks here, we can do the same thing in forecasting bushfire. And that's a good suggestion. Thank you.
Quick question. How does your methodology compare to some of the models used to assess the impact of climate change and its impact on extreme rainfall events?
Very good question, that one. In fact, I could have even prefaced what I was saying. I don't have a view, or I'm not trying to embark on answering any questions regarding, well, in effect, I am addressing climate change because climate's changing all the time, yes. I just let the data speak for itself and the models work out what I can. That might be something we can explore in future. I mean, I know everyone's talking about climate change, big effect. Climate change has been around for centuries, millennia, in the sense that everyone's getting hit by the unseen
So I think if I can get my predictability of the models up, if that'd be task one, getting better R squareds, and then we can look at the fine tuning it for the things that you're suggesting. So you're talking about, what would you be talking about? I know you talk about climate change. This is all climate change, but you're talking about changes over time. And that's a good question, because implicit in all the analysis is that the, I call it ergodicity, as in the distributions are constant over time. That's essentially what I'm talking about. The distributions relative to the factors have been assumed to be constant over time. It's implicit because I've said, I've used stuff prior to 31st of December 1989, and I've assumed that the distributional aspects around the factors will continue. So you're quite right. That's not factored in. That's something dynamic. And until I get R squareds better, I'm wasting my time doing anything else.
Thank you. Okay, we're out of time. Can I encourage you to fill in your online feedback? I'm sure you've all done it many times by now, so you know exactly what to do. So please do that. And please join me in thanking Kevin.